Mike, you're one of a handful of musicians I've talked to for the podcast who first came to prominence through the BBC Young Musician of the Year. Indeed, you were in the very first competition, weren't you?
Yes, that's right.
Why did you go in for it in the first place?
Well, do you know, I found a leaflet in my local school, Feltham Comprehensive, and I just thought, well, good fun. I saw BBC TV, thought, oh, you have to have a go on the television, this is great. So I entered it, but I do remember, even now, I mean, this was back in, I entered the competition in 1977, the actual finals took place in 78, but we had to put all this repertoire down for each round, and there were something like five rounds. I don't think they do that now, but and we had to play, you know, the recital programmes had to last about pieces down that I didn't know. I just went through my filing cabinet with all my music. I thought, oh, I'll put this piece down, put another piece down. And for the concerto, I put a concerto I'd never heard before, which was Finzi's clarinet concerto. And I didn't expect to get through to the final. And of course I did. And the semi-final and the class final and then the concerto final all happened in the same week. It's very different now. They have sort of like 6 months to prepare the concerto. I had 2 days to learn it from scratch because I really didn't think I was going to get through.
It's fascinating to see when you look down the list of people, and you can do on various websites, who got through to the finals and of course who won. It's fascinating to see just how many of today's leading musicians did actually do pretty well in that competition.
Yeah. Funny enough, I was playing in a chamber music festival in Clandeboy in Northern Ireland. It was Barry Douglas, he runs it, and of course we were in the same competition together, but he came third in the piano class. Yeah. And look what he's doing now, you know, it's extraordinary. And in my class, the bassoon player Robin O'Neill came third, and he's doing wonderful things, you know, in the principal bassoon of the Philharmonia, conducting, and in my group London Winds. So it just,
no, the list is endless. But yeah. Did it turn things around for you? It must have been sort of the beginning, really, wasn't it?
It did, actually. At the time, I thought in a very positive way, because of course the final then was prime time viewing, BBC One, Saturday evening.
Yes.
It was instead of the X Factor, if you like.
Well, and there were only three channels.
Yeah, that's right. And it attracted some like 13. Oh, correct. Yeah, 13 million viewers. Mm. So that's an awful lot. And then, of course, we didn't know what to expect at the end of it. And suddenly, you know, the weeks after the competition, we're getting the postman will come along with dustbin liners full of letters. Unbelievable. I mean, what are you supposed to do at 16 with letters, you know, asking you to sign a photograph and send it back? And a lot of them were offers of concerts. I didn't have a manager, so I went out and bought a typewriter. And I used to, you know, say we'd have a recital in Bear's Den in Scotland, and say, yes, you know, what's, they asked me the fee. I said, I don't know. What about £50 and a cup of tea, sort of thing? And that's when I was still at school. So I'd go up on the train, do the recital, and come back on the sleeper. And I remember going straight into a geography O-level, straight from, you know, so I was combining schoolwork and sort of concert work at the same time.
It gave you an early taste, though, of what was to come, didn't it? Was it attractive to you? Actually want to throw school in and get on with it?
So, absolutely. Absolutely. I thought it was the best thing, you know, I can imagine. So I thought, well, yes, well, here I am. I can be going out doing what I want to do, i.e. concerts, earn money from playing the clarinet. I can give up school. I didn't. I was advised to stay, and I'm glad.
Who advised you?
Oh, my teacher. Quite a few people. They kept my feet on the ground, which is great.
It must be really hard, though, to keep your feet on the ground after 13 million people have seen you, and you get sack loads of letters, and you get offers of work. It must be so hard to keep discipline when you're at an age where you don't really quite know what discipline is in that regard.
Well, that's right. That's right. I mean, I did have a very good teacher at that time, and he absolutely, you know, he looked at all the letters. No, don't do this. Perhaps do that concert, and so on. And I carried on. I mean, so in fact, the last, you know, between 16 and 18, my A-level years, so to speak, were very difficult ones because I just wanted to, you know, I was ready to go, but I was being sort of kept firmly on the ground, which was a good thing. And in fact, it was when I, at 18, went to the Royal College of Music as a full-time student in my first week. I won a competition which meant more winning that than entering the BBC, funny enough, which was, it was the Leeds competition for musicians. Obviously not as high profile in the sense that it wasn't on the television and it didn't reach the millions, but it reached the right people, i.e. impresarios, critics, festival directors, orchestral managers, those sort of things. And winning that meant that really did kind of launch me into what I call the serious musical world, whereas the BBC kind of launched me, which was great, into a lot of more popular events.
Mm.
It was the leads that launched me into that, what I call the international music circuit.
So around this age, late teens, early 20s, and before you made your celebrated debut at Carnegie Hall, were you already thinking about the kind of music that you thought you would specialise in? I mean, it's probably the wrong word really, but were you thinking of repertoire that perhaps suited your playing already by that point?
No. But the funny thing you should say, because in my first term after the Leeds competition, and my first term at the college, I was invited to join the National Ensemble and the London Sinfonietta.
Hmm.
Both, of course, highly respected ensembles, but particularly the London Sinfonietta, known for contemporary music. So I joined both, combined my solo work around the two things, and my college, supposed to be a student of college as well. And what happened? Yes, I joined the Sinfonietta, and I remember the very first concert playing some really difficult music, and I was a total fish out of water. I really didn't know where to start, because up until then I'd only played the standard repertoire, Mozart and Weber, Brahms, you know, all the stuff that we're kind of, the clarinet's known for. But then suddenly to go and play things by Birtwistle and Oliver Nussen and Xenakis, what am I supposed to do? How do I count this? I tell you, I learned very fast.
Well, you must have been surrounded, I'm sure you were at that point, by a lot of pretty experienced hands there.
Total, absolute. The musicians I still respect most of all in the whole music profession. And I think, actually, they're just really not, appreciated enough for their amazing talents. Because they not only can play, do they play all this incredibly difficult contemporary music, you know, complex rhythms, they can still play all the mainstream repertoire, and you know, and they're so modest with it. It's incredible. I learned very, very fast and began very early on with the Sinfonietta and the Nash to really enjoy contemporary music. I thought, wow, what a challenge. It kept my mind fresh, and it was a real challenge.
It was actually the death of two very well-known members of the orchestra. I mean, first Chris Van Camp and the cellist, and then more recently Sebastian Bell.
Yeah.
When you read their obituaries, you realise that these were people completely dedicated to new music. And you need people like that, don't you?
Oh, yeah.
It must be quite invigorating to be in an ensemble that allows you to be like that.
Absolutely. I mean, I learned so much from them, and their love of of contemporary music and music. Imagine you get this huge piece put in front of you for the first time, and you've got to make something of it. You've never heard it before. It's so easy for all of us that to sit down, whether you're a pianist playing Rachmaninoff concerto or a clarinetist playing Mozart clarinet concerto, to be influenced by recordings and musicians in the past playing these pieces. But with contemporary music, we're pioneers. And I mean, I suppose it inspired me then to go out and start asking composers to write works for me.
Well, we'll come to that in a bit. I mean, you were still very young when you joined the Sinfonietta then, and I suppose it must have been a fabulous part of your development as a musician then, because you're still presumably developing.
Oh, yeah.
You're developing a style, a sound, and an understanding of music.
Yeah, we never stop. I mean, I can have a little break, which I had done over the summer, and I took my kids on holiday, and so I didn't take the clarinet, and coming back, it's so fresh.
Mm.
It's really wonderful. You find a different approach. You find something new with the piece I'm playing. I'm practicing the Mozart for for the CBSO concerts, actually, and again, and I've found something new, which is great. So have a little break, come back to it, and yeah, so you're reinventing all the time.
Because you do travel a lot, don't you?
Yes, I do. I would say
with the clarinet, of course.
With the clarinet, mostly. I would say about half the year.
Yes.
Of travel.
That's a lot to take in. I suppose there's so much time travelling and so much time then adjusting to time and place and all the rest of it that I suppose the practice in some sort of way can actually be pushed to the side if you're not careful.
Well, it is. I mean, practice is basically now rehearsals. Mm. So a rehearsal for a concerto is my practice time as well. So you have to find a way mentally. Before I would go to a rehearsal, practiced. Now I turn up to a rehearsal and I practice. So you just have to adjust. It can work. It's not a problem. But
you were an orchestral musician, weren't you? You were principal clarinet in the Philharmonia for, what was it, 6 years?
Something like that. 7 years. Yeah.
That's a completely different lifestyle, though, isn't it, to being a soloist?
Yes.
But did it suit you?
It did. I mean, my goodness me, especially for a clarinet, for a wind instrument in a principal chair, to play some of these amazing works. And it was, in my time there, the music director was Giuseppe Sinopoli. Mm. He was quite a controversial conductor, but he had a love for the big works of Mahler, Strauss, Wagner, Bruckner. So what a way to be sort of introduced to these pieces. And of course, I combine the orchestral work with the Philharmonia, with the London Sinfonietta, the Nash, and my solo work. So I really was working, I could safely say, 365 days a year, which was very hard.
It's a very different way of playing, though, also, isn't it, within an orchestra? I mean, I know a number of high-profile soloists who shall remain nameless who find it very difficult when they on the occasions that they have played within orchestras.
Yeah.
It just doesn't quite suit them. It's sound.
Yeah. I mean, not only is it different technically, I mean, meaning that you need to get a slightly different setup for the instrument, for the clarinet, you know, the reed. You just need a different kind of reed that's going to cope with getting through an orchestral concert as opposed to a concerto. It's the mental. You're part of a team. You don't want to let them down. If you're standing in front of an orchestra concerto, if you make a mistake, you've only got yourself to blame. You make a mistake in sitting in the orchestra, you're letting the whole orchestra down. So it is difficult, I must say, if you're not used to it. I think, again, my admiration for the orchestral players that do it day in, day out, and how they can churn it all out absolutely brilliantly. Amazing.
It's unusual, though, isn't it, to find a wind soloist who's now a famous soloist who didn't spend some time in an orchestra, unlike, for example, a pianist or a violinist, say, or even some cellists who are soloists from the get-go.
Yeah.
They never play as part of an ensemble.
That's right.
Almost all the wind soloists that I can think of were at some point you know, members of an orchestra, you know, even people like Jimmy Galway,
yeah,
been a principal of the Berlin Philharmonic. Exactly. A lot of people don't realise that about him. And
that's right.
Jack Brimer, of course.
Yes. Gervais Depardieu.
Yeah.
Or so many. I mean, yes, you can name them. I think all the established wind soloists certainly did their sort of apprentice work, if you like, in an orchestra.
But what made you make the leap? I mean, I know you were still doing Sinfonietta and Nash and others, but what made you decide to throw in the London orchestral life and become a fully-fledged soloist?
Well, it's a difficult one. I better start back there, but as a student, I played in the National Youth Orchestra of Great Britain, and I loved it. And then we spoke about the young musician and the Leeds, and it led to sort of very much a full-time solo life. And then the Nash and the Sinfonietta combined with the solo, it just seemed an obvious way to go into the orchestra. Now, one thing I didn't mention is that I did, when with the London Symphony Orchestra, when Jack Brimer was still principal clarinet, and they were doing the a Beethoven series in London with Abbado, and Jack Brimer fell ill, and I went in as a kind of rather green, straight up from National Youth Orchestra, and played in a lot of those concerts.
Wow.
And I was terrified. And actually, I have to say, I mean, nothing went wrong, but it put me off of playing in an orchestra. So that's why it took me quite a while to then, you know, the opportunity came along to join the Philharmonia. I remember turning up for the first, it was a recording session in the Royal Albert Hall of overtures, popular overtures. And I was absolutely terrified. And then they asked me afterwards, would I like to join? I thought, oh, okay. Actually, it wasn't that bad then. And I stuck it out for 7 years. And I say stuck it out because the last 2 years, although I loved it, it became impossible. Something had to give. Mm. And I suppose my first love is still solo repertoire. I mean, I feel I've got something to say there. And so I was finding it very difficult to combine absolutely everything.
I mean, we've mentioned Jack Brymer's name twice now. Is he an influential figure in British clarinetists' life? Because he's such a legendary name to so many people. Yeah. I mean, people beyond music as well. Yes. I mean, he's one of those names, isn't he?
Yes, he was a household sort of personality on Radio 3 and Home and Bound, I think it was, wasn't he? Or something.
But he also played in orchestras all over the country. I mean, often playing the Mozart, of course. Yes. He's just one of those names that's just been around.
That's right. Yes, he was. I mean, my the biggest influence, the reason I started playing the clarinet, actually, was Gervais Depailler, who was principal clarinet at the London Symphony before Jack Brymer. So I got to know Jack Brymer only later on in life, I suppose. But, yeah, I mean, he was certainly, I think, a big influence at that time for British wind playing altogether. He helped, let's say, establish the clarinet as a solo instrument.
Popularise the clarinet, really.
Yeah.
I mean, not quite in the same way, but almost the same way that Galway popularised the flute, simply by being very visible.
Exactly. And introducing a lot of the repertoire other than Mozart to the audiences, which I think is incredibly important because we do have some great stuff there to play.
Well, and I mean, I played in orchestras at least 10 times accompanying Brymer playing the Mozart.
Oh, really?
At least, I would say. And it was one of those pieces that he took all over the place, of course. Mm. Let's talk about that piece, because it is central to the clarinet repertoire, isn't it?
Yeah.
So just talk me through it, how important it is, really, and whether it still presents challenges. You were talking about how it brings up new things for you when you come back to it. But what are the challenges for the piece?
I'm often asked, you must have played it lots of times. The answer is yes. In Mozart's year, it was a couple of years ago or something, I played it 22 times in 1 month, month of January, but with different orchestras, starting off with the Leipzig Gewandhaus, and then with the Academy St. Martin's, and then in Holland. So all these different orchestras. Now, challenge number one, pitch. So you're dealing with different pitch orchestras. In Leipzig, 4-4-5, the concert bay pitched at 4-4-5, and then in London at 4-40. So you need an instrument that's going to be flexible enough to deal with all these problems. Now,
just one. You don't use lots of different.
No, I use one instrument, and of course I play the Mozart on a modern copy of the original Bassett clarinet, which is slightly longer than normal clarinet. So some extra notes down the bottom. So, you know, that's challenge number one. You've got to play at the right pitch with one instrument with all these different orchestras. So that's my answer. Yes, that keeps me fresh because it feels like a different piece each time I play. But I must say, it's a piece of perfection from beginning to end. And it's something, I must say, how can you tire of it? How? Even when I'm driving along in the car on Classic FM and I hear it, I want to pull over and actually just listen. I must listen to it. It doesn't matter who's playing it. And I have certain views about that, of course, because I've got my own way.
Of course.
It doesn't matter who's playing it. I just have to listen to it because it's a work of great beauty.
It's a different way of concerto playing, though, than, say, something like, I don't know, to take, for example, Elliot Carter.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, any number of other concertos that are a bit more about acrobatics, if you like. There are no acrobatics in this. Or are there?
It's one of the technically one of the most demanding works still. Now, why? And you think, well, we've got Weber concertos and Spohr concertos, which are the sort of Paganini equivalent of a clarinet. And they require real pyrotechnics. But the Mozart, you need such a clean technique. Every single note matters, and it really does matter. One note slightly out of place, and you're going to have 3,000 people in the audience go, ooh, if you do that with another piece, you can get away with it somehow. But it's a piece of technical perfection, and it is, it is technically difficult still, even with you know, techniques have gone, they've got better and better and better over the years. But you know, it's still hard to play. Don't know why. It's maybe that's the reason we are scared of the piece.
Is there a temptation, because it's so popular and so well known, to tweak it a little bit, to actually try and do something slightly new? I don't quite know what that would be.
No,
you know what I mean?
I do know exactly what you mean. And I think it is very tempting, particularly with the... I'm not into the original instrument movement, but I listen to it, so I know exactly what they're getting at and what they're trying to do with music of that period. And it is all too easy to start going down the path and, oh, a little twiddle here, let's try ornamenting this phrase. Oh yeah, that worked. And before you realise, you start changing, and you can change the piece completely. And I'm guilty of it. I have done it, and I've listened back on the radio after I've done a performance and said, that was too much. And I'll then go back to just playing it as it's written. And I must say, I'll tell you quickly, I had a fantastic experience early this year. I saw the original manuscript, which is... I was playing the Mozart in Switzerland, in a city called Winterthur near Zurich, and the manager of the orchestra said, oh, have you seen the manuscript? I said, no. I said, where is it? I said, it's in the front of house. I went out, and there it was, in a glass case. No guards, no lock and key, just in a glass case. And they took it out, and I put my white gloves on. I was able to look through it, because they were actually putting it underground for the next 10 years to... also to preserve it. It's getting a little worn after a couple of hundred years.
And it actually is in his hand.
Oh yeah,
it's not a copy.
Oh yeah, no, it's right. It's the original.
What do you learn from seeing that up close?
How I learned how much is left of the performer. Yeah. So
do you mean in dynamics and phrasing?
Yes, articulation. It's well, actually, even. When I was talking about ornamenting, I mean, it is totally without, you know, any embellishments. There'll be the odd piano, the odd forte, just as a sort of reminder, if you like. But otherwise, it's just left to the... And that was good for me. Mm. It gave me great confidence to think, well, actually, then I am free to interpret this piece the way I want to as a performer without... You know, because so many pieces, whether even looking at Beethoven or Brahms, if all the nuances are there and you have to follow them if you're going to be faithful to the score. But with the Mozart, it is left to the performer. And I think that's why we hear probably so many different interpretations of the Mozart, incredibly different when it comes to articulation, dynamics and ornaments. Maybe that's why the piece comes up so fresh every time.
Well, even though you got nice... and close to the original manuscript from Mozart. Mm. Of course, when you commission a work, you have the advantage of a real live composer to work with.
Yeah.
That must be a new and exciting challenge each time it's presented to you.
Oh, it is. Yeah, it's wonderful. And when I've asked composers to write, I've had some really interesting responses. one in particular was John Adams. I asked him for quite a while if he would write a concerto. And
he's a busy man.
And he was very busy. Yes, he kept saying, he was very busy, I'm very busy. And no was the answer. Oh, drat. Because, you know, he played the clarinet.
Yes.
And I thought he would just write something really good for the instrument. Out of the blue, he said, yeah, I'm ready. I'll write one. So... The performance was planned in London with the London Sinfonietta, with John Adams conducting. And a week before the performance, I still didn't have the music. And as far as I was concerned, he told me it was going to be a one movement, 10 to 12 minute piece. You know, one movement. And I phoned him about 3 days before the performance. So it was like a day before the rehearsal, before he was co coming over to England, just to say, you know, is there a part, or are you bringing it with you? He said, oh, yeah, I'll fax it through. So I switched on my fax and it came through. One movement. It didn't stop. Suddenly came a second movement. And then it didn't stop there. And then a third movement. So it turned into a 30-minute, three-movement concerto.
This is Gnarly Buttons.
Gnarly Buttons, yeah. And so 3 days before the concert, I had to learn this rather difficult piece. You know. And I didn't have a say, style or the kind of technical content or what have you. So that's the challenge. And
a bit of a, it's almost a compliment, isn't it? Because he presumably had utter confidence in your abilities to be able to pull it off.
Yeah, I think so. But he said he knew my personality, he knew my clarinet playing very well. So he just wrote, he said he wanted to write something that was going to be a challenge for me and probably I would find difficult.
Mm.
Yes, I did find difficult, so only 3 days before the concert.
It's probably the best known of the concertos you've commissioned.
Yeah, isn't it? I think so. Yeah. I think so. I've done, well, actually there's another one by Mark Anthony Turnage, which...
Is that Riffs and Refrains?
Riffs and Refrains, yeah, which I'm hoping will get more outings. It's a very dense work, I mean, heavily scored, and it's tricky to bring off because, you know, the clarinet is really fighting against a big orchestra. It's going to be good. And another one that I adore, and I think when it reaches these shores properly, it's going to take off in a big way. It's a partner piece to the Mozart, in fact. It's by a lady, an Australian Russian from Georgian or Tashkent, whatever that is.
Right.
Yeah. Her name is Elena Katschernin. And if you know that famous advert, Lloyd's Bank advert, I don't sing it because I'm not too embarrassed, because with the soprano up high, with the train going through the clouds, it's a part of a ballet score. And Lloyd's Bank heard it. And now, I remember Elena from 12 years ago, the National Tour, we played a piece of hers around Australia on tour. And she was, you know, a composer writing real in-your-face stuff, heavy-duty bang stuff, modern contemporary music. And she found she really wasn't going anywhere for her. So she decided to change her style completely. And she's writing more popular stuff and with a lot of success. So she wrote me a Bassett clarinet concerto, part of the Mozart, same scoring as the Mozart. And it's called Ornamental Airs. It's brilliant. It's one of the best pieces I've ever played in an entire repertoire.
Uh-huh.
And I love it. I mean, not only is it just a technical challenge, but it's so beautiful. It's a lot of fun. So I hope audiences over here will have a chance to hear it one day.
Do you tend to have particular conversations with the composers about the sorts of things that you want from them? I mean, are there corners of the clarinet technique that are as yet untouched that you really want to explore?
No. I think it's been tried and tested, to be honest. I don't want to... Perhaps I'm getting too far down the line in my playing career to sort of want to sort of stand in my head in a dustbin and play the clarinet, that kind of thing, which I'm sure a lot of people are doing. I'd rather not. I'm perhaps still fairly traditional in that way. And certainly when it comes to challenges and technical challenges of the instrument, I think the pieces that have been written for me, we've taken them to, you know, a step further, which I'm happy about.
Well, but the question is, are other clarinetists taking those pieces up? I mean, I know Gnarly Buttons is played quite a lot, because that's the challenge, isn't it? The next step.
Yeah, the next step.
After the premiere.
Yeah.
And hope that other clarinetists pick up the piece and take them and do their own thing with it.
I hope so. I mean, of course, a lot of pieces like the Turnage and this Cat's Churning are still within what they call a 3 month, a 3 year exclusive period.
Ah,
which
so
means,
only you can I don't think people realise that those exist, actually.
Yeah, I mean, that's something that the player, you know, concerned, their manager will make sure they'll try and get written into the contract with the publisher. So the person, like myself in this case, I have a great opportunity to take it around the world and present the new piece in all these different orchestras, different parts of the globe, if you like.
Mm. Yeah. But then they get released.
Then it's released
into the big wide world, and other clarinetists can come and play them.
And some find a real secure place, you know, in the repertoire. Some just fall, and that's never to be played again. Unfortunately, I don't know why that is. I really don't.
Well, where do you think young clarinet playing is, particularly in this country at the moment? There seem to be some phenomenally talented technicians out there. What's your take on the general world of clarinet playing at the moment with young people?
I think you're right. I think the technical perfection has reached such a high level. I worry about the rest of the, if you like, the all the things that go with being an artist. Emotionally stable, musically aware, and being able to project your own emotions and personality. For me, I'm not sure, instead of things moving forward, it seems that it's reached a stage where the technique has become paramount.
Yes.
The rest of it is slightly left behind, and I don't know what can be done. I had this conversation in the summer at a clarinet course, and I was just amazed, one after the other, coming along, fingers flying everywhere, you know, really whiz, whiz, whiz. And they weren't concerned with sound.
Mm.
They hadn't a clue about the style of the music they were playing. And that worried me even more somehow. And I said to them, I started questioning their approach to learning a piece and performing a piece, and what are they thinking about, what they're aiming for. And they said, one after the other, well, making sure we get all the right notes. And I said, well, sorry, I think very differently. I don't mind hearing the odd bloomer if there is if that person is going to touch me, and pull the heartstrings. I'd rather a few mistakes coming in. Mm. Now, I do put it down to, we were able to analyse what was going on at the moment. And when you listen to CDs, which a lot of them do, of course, what are they hearing? What are they listening to? They're listening to technical perfection, because it is possible with the world we're living in and the technical perfection with gadgets and so on. And when you can take one note out of the phrase and drop it into another phrase if there's a mistake, the recording, it's so advanced. That's why I'm going for the option of live recording. And if there's a little bloomer, so be it. But that's me playing. And I think the younger generation are listening to this technical perfection and trying to recreate that with the heel at the expense of the music.
We started this conversation talking about Young Musician of the Year. It reminds me that we did a few years ago have another clarinetist win, Mark Simpson. And what I liked about him was that it seemed to me that he lived the music.
Yeah.
He's actually sort of really gone on much more now to be a composer, hasn't he, than a performer.
Yes, yeah.
But he seemed to be like that. He loves contemporary music. He wanted to bring new concertos in, and he wanted to communicate that to an audience. I thought that was quite effective, but very, very unusual.
Yeah, it is unusual. I don't know. I mean, good for him to try and do that. I think there are obstacles, as we know, in the climate, musical climate we're in. And there are these big halls that managers of orchestras are trying to fill. They're trying to fill 2,000, 3,000 seats of halls because they have to make the figures.
Mm.
And by putting in a modern work, it shouldn't put people off. And if only people were really, try it and listen to it. Gosh, actually, it was a lot of fun. I really enjoyed it. It was fascinated by it. It can be more interesting than going to your usual a three-course dinner concert of a popular overture, concerto, symphony.
Yeah, I mean, what we're saying, I suppose, is the world is very different the world is very different in 2008 for those that reached the finals of the Young Musician of the Year than it was 30 years ago for you when you reached the finals in 1978.
Absolutely, very different. And I mean, so much so when, you know, when I said I joined the Nash and the Symphony Editor, and I just have to. I moved house recently and found in a cardboard box all the advanced schedules back in 1980. And the amount of work, the amount of concerts that were going on, modern music, one day after the next, these incredibly complex programmes. And I remember, you know, the Queen Elizabeth Hall being full for them, and, you know, it's a very different world now.
Well, Michael Collins, it's been a great pleasure talking to you. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Tony.